Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Norma Walden, chair of the club's International Relations Forum. We also welcome our online and radio listeners, and we invite our audience to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. Today, we present two speakers to discuss the tragic issue of human trafficking. Jaume Narona began advocating for immigrant victims of crime in the U.S. in 2004, and for the past 2 years was the anti-trafficking program manager of the SAGE project here in San Francisco. She managed the Cross Bay Collaborative Initiative to combat human trafficking and supervised direct services to survivors. Before moving to the Bay Area, Ms. Narona was the anti-human traffic outreach specialist with Tapestry, Inc., a nonprofit social services agency working with survivors of human trafficking in the southeast region of the United States. About 2 weeks ago, she accepted a new position, managing a collaborative which provides outreach, community building, and community organizing activities for residents of SRO residential hotels throughout the Mission District. For our program today, she will share her experience at the SAGE project, working with human trafficking survivors in the Bay Area. We're also pleased to welcome Hadiana Utarte, PhD. She's the community project coordinator of the Asian Women's Shelter. She joined AWS in 2000 and is currently responsible for two main projects: one, anti-trafficking, and two, queer Asian women and transgender support and services. Her responsibilities include program development, networking and collaboration, and case management. At the Asian Women's Shelter, she also works at the crisis line, support groups, community building, and networking. Previously, Hadiana lived and worked in Honolulu for 14 years, where she earned her PhD in political science and worked as co-director of the Women's Center at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. Please welcome them to the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening, everybody. Can you hear me? So I am Hadiana. It's like, hey, Diana. And I'm going to start our presentation with a short DVD that is actually created by a survivor of human trafficking. It's just 2 minutes.
When I first met them at the interview, I think to myself, they are nice people. I have been working for them for almost a year in Hong Kong when they asked me to come to the United States. At first, I said no, because I don't know anyone there, and it's so far from my family. But they tell me how good my future will be and show me their big, beautiful house. They take care of all the travel arrangements. I just sign what they want me to sign and hope things will work out. Things are different when we get to the US. They take my passport and let my visa expire. They tell me not to talk to anyone, not to make friends. They say everybody outside the house is a bad person. Saya kerja siang dan malam, tak kenal waktu mereka perintah saya. Mereka membuat tempat di garasi untuk saya tidur. Tempatnya kecil, mereka harus pesan kasur yang bisa ditaruh di sana. Tempatnya gelap, tidak ada jendela, selalu dingin biarpun musim panas. When they're at work, they call the house to check on me all the time, and if I don't pick up the phone, they yell at me later. They say, I've been calling for a while and no one answered. Where were you? Can't you hear? I ask them to send me home but they never do. I don't know where to go. I cry in my room, hoping for a miracle, hoping they will buy me a ticket and let me go back to my family. Saya bertanya pada diri saya sendiri, adakah jalan keluar untuk semua ini? Saya bertahan selama 3.5 tahun. Saya sudah putus asa sekali. One day, when I'm walking their dog, I meet a neighbor. I'm afraid to talk to her at first. But over the next few weeks, I share what is happening. She finds me a lawyer who says she can help. I stay at the woman's shelter while my case and documents are being processed. They give me a safe home and help me regain my confidence. Most of all, they give me back my hope.
So I'm going to spend a few minutes at sharing with you our work here at Asian Woman Shelter. I also want to let you know that we don't do this by ourselves. We do this in collaboration with other organizations such as APILO. APILO stands for Asian Pacific Islander Legal Outreach, and they are our attorneys that usually deal with human trafficking. Now, this lady that you saw, her name is Adi, and I just want to share that she is okay now. She is actually trying to get her associate degree, and she has a regular job. So there is a hope, you know, after so many years that she was surviving. At Asian Woman Shelter, we saw human trafficking cases since we were open in 1988. At that time, it was not called human trafficking. So, you know, the organization took them in as victims of violence in general. I started this job in my position since 2006. So between 2006 until today, I would say these are the type of cases that that I have had, which is domestic worker, nanny, babysitting, hotel workers, restaurant, fishermen, and also commercial sex. I'm going to share with you 4 short stories so that you, to illustrate the cases that I have seen. Number one is the case of Lily. Similar to Adi, Lily also from Indonesia, and she decided to go abroad because her older brother actually working in South Korea, and she saw that her older brother made a lot of money, and she wanted to help her family. She was 23 when she got a job offer to go to Medina in Saudi Arabia. So she worked for an Egyptian diplomat. I can share you the details of this story because it's over. When it's still going on, I can't say very much. Anyway, what was interesting with Lily was that when she was at the airport, when the person who helped her to get a job, the person is from employment agency, the guy gave her a ticket and also told her that she will be paid $175 per month. They promise it's $200, but she cannot cancel it. She was already going to fly. So she didn't really feel good about it, but she couldn't cancel it. So she went on and worked for the family. She worked for this family for 3 years. They brought her to here, to Hillsboro, near here in California. She worked pretty much 12 hours per day, working in a 3-story house, washing clothes, ironing clothes, and also washing their 2 SUV every day, rain or shine. The interesting thing is that she was not
She was not paid for 3 years. She was not allowed to call her family in Indonesia. If they call, I think it's only for Muslim holiday, which is the Eid and New Year's Eve. Even then, the employer actually has to call, have made the phone call and give the phone to her. So the employer, the diplomat, sexually harass her often, and the wife and the children, you know, beat her and yell at her often. So after 3 years and a half, she actually ran away to a neighbor, similar to the story that you saw. And the neighbor called Catholic Charities, and Catholic Charities then contacted us. This is a case in 2006. Another case that that's interesting is somebody called, I would call her Lenny. She is actually 63 years old. So one is 23, this one is 63. But she was brought here actually by her own sister from Mexico with the pretense of sponsoring her to get a green card. Well, what happened was that the sister actually forced her to work in a catering business night and day. And similar to the story in the video, she got a small room in the garage and didn't get paid at all. The hardest thing to hear about Lenny for me at the time was she actually lost her denture because their dog actually grabbed the denture and chewed them. So it's awful. It's awful. And so actually Lenny's brother took her out of the situation and brought her to our attorney, and our attorney connect Lenny to both Asian Woman Shelter and SAGE. The third story is about Sony. Sony is a man. Most of the time we thought that human trafficking is women and sex trafficking, so we want to say that there's a lot of men also that are victims of human trafficking. Sony is from Thailand. He was a fisherman. He worked in a Japanese fishing boat, and he had a really good experience, but then in 2010, he worked in a fishing boat here in the water of San Francisco with a family that owned a fishing boat from San Jose. Again, he worked for 12, 15 hours per day. He was only given food twice a day and was only allowed to remain on the deck most of the time, except for sleeping. And he had a coworker that got hit a lot on his head because the guy was a farmer. He didn't even know what he was doing, and so he got hit a lot. So these two men actually was trying to leave, but they couldn't. They were afraid to leave because their visa only allowed them to touch the U.S. boat, not the U.S. soil. Now, what prompted them to leave was one day Sonny actually got really injured. He said that a small shark was caught in their fishnet, and the boss told him to grab the fishnet without any, any protection gear. So he did, but the big fish actually spun, so the net spun as well, and so his right finger was caught in the net and got twisted. So his right hand swelled immediately, and his boss gave him ice and told him to rest for that night. But then the next day, he was supposed to work again. So I think a few days after that, they actually ran away from here, from Fisherman Wharf, not too far away from here, and they found Asian Woman Shelter through a priest. The last story, I think I have two more minutes. And the last story that I want to share is Angel. Angel came to California from the Philippines with John and Jenny, who actually sponsored her to come here. John and Jenny are a very nice couple that Angel met at the bar that Angel used to work at. Angel said that they always treated her very kindly and nicely and never judged her, even though she occasionally worked as a dancer there. They invited her to come and work in California and told her that she could go to school as well. Well, a year later, Angel ended up in an emergency room, and that's when we heard from Angel. She actually attempted suicide by taking a whole bottle of Tylenol. When she became conscious, the nurse who spoke her language, the nurse was speaking Tagalog, and the nurse spoke to her and told her that she would help her. Angel believed in the nurse and told her everything. So the nurse actually called Sage, and then put together at Sage and Asian Woman Shelter supported Angel. What happened was that Angel never got to go to school. She worked in their house, cooking and cleaning, but she told me that she's. From her story, I feel that she has a conflicting feeling about John and Jenny, the people who brought her. She said that she had relationship with both of them. I don't quite know what she meant. But she said that they really care for her. But then she also felt trapped and couldn't get, and also insulted and depressed because she was forced to participate in their sex parties. And she was forced to have sex with their friends. So she actually turned to alcohol to ease her pain, and eventually she decided to try to commit suicide. I'm going to stop here for now, and I'll have my coworker, my colleague, Chachma, to share with you her work.
Thank you. So my name is Jajma Noronha, and the SAGE project started working with survivors of sexual exploitation. SAGE was actually founded by Norma Hotelling. She was a survivor of child sexual exploitation in the Mission District, not too far from here. And as she started working with women involved in the sex industry, she realized also as she advanced the work that wasn't just sex, that was also labor. And SAGE expanded to work with not only domestic minors, but also with foreign-born. So the stories that I will be sharing with you today, I have some domestic servitude case, sex, but I also wanted to add labor as well. I'll try not to repeat some of the trends that Hediana mentioned. The first survivor that I'm explaining that I want to tell her story, her name is Marta. She's originally from Mexico, and she was kidnapped at 9 years old. In Mexico, she was forced to domestic servitude. The trafficker, after kidnapping her, took her to a motel and raped her several times. After he forced her to work at his aunt's farm, and after a while, when she got pregnant, she told him that she was pregnant of him because he would come visit her and sexually assault her. He then started beating her and punching her, hoping that she would have an involuntary abortion, you know, voluntary. But it never happened. After the baby was born, he forced her to take the baby back to her mom's house and told her that if she did not return, he would not only kill her, but kill her son and kill her daughter and also kill her mother. After she dropped the girl, she's then taken to the Mexican and the U.S. border and forced to work to raise the money to pay the smuggling fees to bring her to the United States. Yeah, the United States, she worked in like over 10 different states. One of the things that was most shocking while working with her was the number of men that she was forced to serve within one working shift. The minimum amount that she had to do was $6,000 a month, a week. So that was making an average of 60 men per working shift. The longest amount that she was forced to serve was 101 in one working shift. She was basically on her trafficking situation for almost a decade. And she had another baby with the trafficker. And, you know, one of the times where the traffickers, they used to use a lot of drugs and get drunk. And when they passed out, she was able to gather her belongings, take some money, and run away with her son. It actually took a while for her to have access to services. She was caught by immigration at the Greyhound. She was put into the detention center. She found an attorney that had a couple of malpractices with her. And wasn't into, she was very desperate because she couldn't afford to keep paying the attorney. And she saw an interview of a survivor of human trafficking telling her story and the services that she received. So then she was able to then reach out for help. But it was like 2-3 years after she escaped. The other case that I want to share is, you know, we oftentimes think that of course, there are some vulnerability that makes somebody more prone to be trafficked, but I have also worked with individuals from the most various background. This was a survivor from South Korea that she actually had her PhD. She took some money from loan sharks to start her own business. And when the business went down, they offered her the opportunity to come to the United States and work as a waitress, and that she would be able to pay them back in no time. In a matter of days, they arranged her passport and smuggled her through the Canadian border. When she first got here, after she arrived, was when they told her that the only work available was at host bars, which is basically a place. It's more like a Japanese traditional thing, but we have seen other doings as well. And she worked in California, in Hawaii, in many different host bars, and also at massage parlors. Her debt when she first got here was $20,000. After 10 years, her debt was $60,000. So even though they would give her like half of the money that she was making, she had to pay a house fee, she had to pay for materials, she had to send money for her family. And in South Korea, what she shared with us is that if you don't pay a debt, it gets carried away to your family. And the loan sharks, they were very tight with the mafia. So it took her about 10 years as well to be able to help her family relocate and then leave the situation. Another case that is very common here in the Bay Area is with the cantinas. I don't know if you are familiar, there are Mexican restaurants that during the day they serve food, and at evening they serve, it becomes a club. They have music. So we had actually a case with a few survivors in a mission district where they were forced to work as bartenders, and the owner, the trafficker, was using of sexual exploitation and sexual assault to keep them compliant, as well as immigration threats. One of the survivors got HIV from the traffickers. So there is a lot of health issues that we have to work with when dealing with survivors. And that specific survivor reached out to a medical provider and then was able then referred to the Asian Pacific Islander Legal Outreach. And after we start working with her, she shared her story with some of the people that she was still in contact, and they reached out for help as well. But this is a very common, and even though she wasn't being forced to provide sexual services, they were being sexually abused as a way to keep them compliant and silent, as well as immigration threat. Another case that I wanted to share with you guys is Hediana also mentioned about the diplomats. So I wanted to share like a trend that we are starting to see with the Filipino communities here in San Francisco and in the whole Bay Area. So we see a lot of debt bondage. They are forced to come to the U.S. and do domestic work or also work for the nursing home facilities providing 24 hours care. They are forced to sleep at the garage, or they are forced to sleep on a couch. They're never paid overtime. They never receive any of the labor rights. And one thing that is very specific for the Filipino community is that they have a term for debt bondage. Utanalong, basically, it means that once this person helped your family, you in debt with them for the rest of your life. You are seen by the community as ungrateful if you don't, you know, the whole culture basically create a little platform for that. So you are seen as ungrateful if you do not pay off or work for the trafficker. So there is a lot of, how long do I have? Okay. So there is a lot of guilt, there is a lot of cultural values that are used by the traffickers against survivors. But I feel that the main thing is threats against family members, threats against children, forcing them to have children with the trafficker, and then once the child is born, taking the child from the mother and using that. I had clients that actually stayed in a situation longer, looking for an opportunity to be able to get their children because they didn't want to leave and without their child. So those are the stories that I wanted to share. We felt that we could sit here and just give a formal presentation, but we felt like, you know, actually cases will speak more. Mm-hmm.
So Jajma and I can share what we do if you want to know. But in the meantime, please feel free to ask questions. There is a fact sheet, the green paper. This is a fact sheet from our collaborative, which is five organizations working together to address the issues of human trafficking.
Question.
About the youth, the B visa, that's supposedly the number one.
The T?
The B. I think it's for
employee.
H1B.
It's supposed to check on the victims, on the employees throughout the year. I'm just wondering, was that ever followed up on, or are there statistics on that?
So the H-1B visa is for workers that can come here. My experience, I cannot, speak for the whole, visa itself. My experience is when they first go to the interview at the U.S. Embassy, they explain to them. But after that, there isn't any home visit or follow up per se. So we actually have a lot of cases of traffickers that will use a visa because the visa is tied to the trafficker. The moment that you leave your employment situation, you then can be, you lose your immigration status. So that's a huge increase that we see with traffickers using that visa to maintain control over the survivors. So we do see a lot of cases with the H-1B visa.
Yeah.
Just a reminder for our listening audience that you are listening to a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, with our two speakers, Jajma Narana and Hediana Utarti. And also we will ask that you use the microphone for your questions so that your questions can be part of the recording. It's the microphones here in the aisle. If you have trouble getting to the microphone, our kind volunteer Karen will hand it to you. The microphone, please, sir.
It's for the recording.
Are in any of the stories that you told, were any of the traffickers prosecuted? And are you seeing support by the police or the government as far as going after traffickers in a situation like the cantina or someone that's here that's not necessarily in another place?
Actually, we're not supposed to speak about the legal part. It will be great for you folks actually to invite our attorney to talk about this. But I can tell you some things. What usually happen when somebody come to us and ask for help, we will make sure that they are a human again, right? We give them some food, a place to live, and then we will take them to our attorney at APILO usually as soon as possible. And then our attorney will contact law enforcement. It can be FBI if it is international. It can be U.S. attorney. It can be San Francisco Police Department. And then the law enforcement will determine if you are a bona fide victim or not. And then if you are a bona fide victim, then they will move on with the criminal process. So I would say that from my part, the story of Angel, for instance, the two people have been prosecuted. Their house has been taken away as a way to pay back to Angel because she was with them more than a year. With the fishermen, unfortunately, the FBI did not believe them. So they are still free running around, hopefully not continuing that kind of work. With the first story with the diplomat, they actually left. But not all diplomats get away with that, though, I have to say. Jajma can show you can share with you the other story. With the person in the video, the U.S. attorney are still working on the issue. So what they do is usually they go interview the trafficker. Before there is a conviction, of course, they are still free, living their life as normal. But I would say the chance is 50-50. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with Hediana. From the cases that I shared with you, the only one was prosecuted. The Cantina workers actually got to get some lost wages back, one of the workers, but is at the discretion of law enforcement if they want to prosecute a case or not. Like Hediana say, you need an attorney to explain like all the legal, you know, intricacies, like what's all the details with the law. But if you go to the TIP report, TIP, Trafficking in Person, which is a report done by the Department of State every year, you can see all the prosecutions of human trafficking global in a whole, like every, well, that have been reported with the United States. And from all the prosecutions brought out worldwide, only half ended up in prosecution.
Yeah. Is somebody in
Hi.
The back?
I'm Arlene, previously with Women Organized to Make Abuse Non-Existent.
Oh.
As of 2012, 43% of the California's human trafficking occurs right here in the Bay Area. And with the Super Bowl 50 taking place in Santa Clara in 2016, seems like the report of incidents of human trafficking during these large sporting events are more likely to give rise to an increase in human trafficking activity for labor, as well as for commercial sex. Will you and the San Jose Asian Women Shelters be reaching out to hotel managers and staff in major Bay areas to counter this?
So the question is whether or not we are involved with... I couldn't really hear you, sorry. Can you repeat the question?
She's asking, with the NFL being here in 2016, it's going to be a big event. So mm-hmm. are you going to, your organization's going to reach out to hotels and others who want to bring in women that are trafficked by the people attending these events?
Yes, yes. What we do, the great thing is that in San Francisco we work together, and Woman Inc. is one of our collaborators. And so the city of Mayor Lee actually have a task force on human trafficking. So the city task force is actually working with all organizations to address this issue. And we are a part of the education. And yes, this is a big concern actually when there's a big sporting event.
Another question. You talked about the trafficker, but they often have, I thought, people in the homeland that can go after the families mm-hmm. if the trafficker is caught and imprisoned or in some kind of trouble. Mm. How do you deal with that? Because do our arms of the law at the 50% level who get just the traffickers, do they coordinate with the international feeders?
Mm-hmm. I've majority of the case, I haven't seen the collaboration, but I have worked in cases with, for example, the Mexican consulate. There was definitely a collaboration to arrest, because even though when you think about human trafficking, yes, can be an individual, but oftentimes there is a whole network that supports the trafficking. There is somebody that's going to do the recruiting, somebody that's going to transport, somebody that's going to receive, somebody that is going to exploit, but it can also just be one individual. Like I also work in a case with a Nigerian diplomat called Bidemi Bello, and she got 11 years in jail where there was the collaboration with the government and the FBI. But I feel that that goes to like, what's the relationship between the U.S. and the country? Does the country have laws against human trafficking? Is the country willing to investigate? So it varies, but there are also legal remedies. Like attorneys can apply for an immigration relief, so the survivors can bring some qualifying, what they call immediate relative, to the U.S., but it's a long process. It doesn't happen. And law enforcement can also parole to bring a survivor or a survivor's family if there is immediate threat, but it's very rare, and it depends on the relationship between the U.S. and that country.
I have two questions. One, there was so much publicity and endorsement and discussion when many of us, and probably here, gathered the thousands of votes to get Proposition 35 on the ballot in California, and that passed. And so my question is that Proposition 35, which increased the penalty in that for sex offenders, have you seen that be a help? And my other question is the Senate Bill 1165, which our governor of California will vote on tomorrow, that will require mandatory education for the prevention of sexual exploitation to our middle school children and high schoolers. Are you aware of that? And hopefully, do you think that this will be passed? And do you work along with the Association California Against Slavery?
Do you want to say anything? Do you know about this?
So I'm not aware of the 1165. The Prop 35, I remember that, you know, when first brought it up, many organizations in the Bay Area supported. But as the attorneys started reviewing the law, they saw that it was a lot of gaps in the law. And also, so it basically, like, made labor trafficking look, like, less bad, per se. Like, having less, so that create, like, again, I'm not an attorney and I can't explain all the details, but it creates an imbalance. Like, one trafficking is worse than the other, and we had a very strong focus on sex trafficking. Another thing that happened is from that law, especially for domestic traffic minors, if you are 19 years old that has is a survivor of human trafficking, have been working in a sex industry, and you allow a friend of yours that is under 18 to stay in your house, and that person starts working from your apartment, per se, that 19 years old can now be prosecuted as a trafficker. So there are some gaps in the law that the Human Rights Commission of San Francisco, they were working with the attorneys to address. I haven't seen, like, much change from the law and prosecution. I think the Alameda County District Attorney is doing a lot of prosecution related to human trafficking and really using that law. And the Coalition Against Slavery CAST, they have done a lot of work on policy and also working with survivors. I have worked with them. They have referred cases to us and vice versa. So we do work with them.
Yeah. I just want to add that essentially our workload has not changed. So that's all I can say. And also a reminder, some of this is work is directed for domestic trafficking, because there are a lot of domestic trafficking within the U.S. So that's like another, and Massa's Parlor is another story again. Yeah.
So that's a good segue into my question. Was you said your workload hasn't changed. So how many clients per year do you support, and how many NGOs are similar to yours that are providing services to clients? So I'm looking for kind of some numbers. The green sheet says the majority are in the Bay Area, but it doesn't give you any tangible concept of how many per year for your group and for others.
So the green sheet, this is a representation sort of from our collaborative, and this collaborative might not continue because we actually do not have funding anymore. So this is a collaboration of five organizations, which is APILOR Attorney, SAGE, Asian Woman Shelter, Narica in Berkeley, and also Mujeres Unidas e Activas. So together we are looking at about 80 cases per year, 80 to 100 sometimes. And then what the way we do it is that when our attorney have a case, then they, you know, they assess the legal needs, and then they will say, okay, can SAGE take this case? Can Asian Woman Shelter take this case? So we divide the case. For myself, I would say my workload for trafficking only, and these are people who do not live in the shelter, I would say 15 to 20. And please remember also that these people, these folks, our clients, stay with us for 2-3 years. In domestic violence, we have 12-week program, and then after 12 weeks, we follow them until they're better. So about 6 months-ish case management with human trafficking is like 2 years, because there is no shelter. There is one shelter, Freedom House, in San Mateo for human trafficking, but in San Francisco we do not have shelter for them. So if all the domestic violence shelter is full, then we work with them to find some kind of a safe housing. And then the safe housing that is safe for 3 months might not be safe for the next 3 months, because maybe a friend of a trafficker found them. So we moved them again. And then after 6 months, we need to move them to San Jose. So we need to call the shelters in San Jose. So, you know, it's much more complicated, and it's much more dangerous, because the abuser is not one person, but an array, a group of individuals sometimes. So I would say, my workload is about 15-ish, 15 to 20 per year.
Yeah, at SAGE, on our last fiscal year, we had 2 case managers, so we were able to take more work. So we had about 30 to 40 individuals that we served that were foreign-born. And we also have a youth component at SAGE that works with minors forced into the sex industry, and the case manager on that program had about 100-150 clients, but that actually engaged in services, the number was like about 30-40. But you know, it's hard for you, because you have to follow them up. Because they are within the, you need a whole nude presentation just to talk about domestic minor traffic.
Yeah, so we also work with Lyric, that is Lavender Youth Information and Recreation Services. They mostly work with LGBT youth, and so they have about, I would say, similar to Asian Women Shelter, I would say maybe about 20 plus youth that have been touched by sex trafficking. So I would say we are probably the only ones who actually provide victim services. There's a lot of human trafficking organization out there, but they're mostly doing education and showing films and stuff like that. But the ones that are actually doing case management is probably just us.
When you were speaking about the victims, it sounded like in a lot of cases they were befriended by someone that helped them get services, or they escaped and then connected with a priest or someone else. Do your organizations proactively seek them out? Periodically you hear about houses of prostitution, say in the Richmond District, that move around. So are there resources, or I don't know what else to call it, but how do you get your clients, how do they find out about you? Because they might be completely ignorant of what the services are that you provide.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I'll go first.
The Cross Bay Collaborative that was funded by Department of Health and Human Services to provide outreach. So that was the main focus of the collaborative. There was 5 organizations that basically all we did was reach out to different churches, community members. But another thing that helps clients finding out about services, word to mouth, is one client that goes and talk to the community, or they share the story with a friend, and they know by their own experience, and then they would then refer them for services. But Adriana, yeah. Do you want to add?
It's probably similar. Chachma actually never talk about this. So this is an interesting thing. Many of our clients who call us, they don't call themselves trafficking victim. When Asian Woman Shelter is was founded as domestic violence shelter, so when people call, they say there is a violence in my family. There is some kind of acknowledgement that there is something wrong, that they don't feel safe at home. Now with human trafficking, people call our crisis line and say, "Can you help me find a job?" And we say, "Oh, okay, tell me more." So we would spend 15 minutes or so asking, how did you lose your job? Because the boss trying to rape me. Oh, how long have you been working there? So that make it harder, actually, to not harder, I should say, it require more sensitivity and more more awareness in amongst the crisis line workers and the people who work on the phone to actually capture the situation. So that's one thing to remember. Our outreach, similar to what Chashma said, we often do outreach together, is we work with a lot of community groups. There is Filipino Community Center, there is Vietnamese Community Center, there's also churches. And so we just keep on going to those places and raise awareness about human trafficking, saying that if you hear anything, please give us a call. So a lot of our referral is actually from a priest, from a Good Samaritans, from teachers who feel that the mother of these children seems to be having a situation. And oftentimes it got mixed up with domestic violence. Last week, actually, I am originally from Indonesia, and I'm trying to reach out to Indonesian community. Last week, there was an interesting situation. I was in a fundraising event, and somebody called my cell phone, and they said, and this man, who is a church activist, he was calling for an Indonesian woman in Chicago trying to leave. So it's interesting how personal relationship, you know, makes a difference sometimes. So, and a lot of our clients also needing more services that Asian Woman Shelter cannot give, so I would send them to SAGE. But they don't want to go to SAGE. I take them to SAGE and meet Chashma, and then they will open up and open to other things. So it's much more tricky than domestic violence, for sure. Yeah.
And another thing, too, like if you ever do come across someone, and that's a great point, not to just use human trafficking, like give a case scenario, explain a situation, because if you just say human trafficking, in many languages you cannot even translate. Mm-hmm. So just, I think the best way that I've found to connect with survivors has been like giving case scenarios and how we help them and what was their story so they can relate and then share.
It seems, well, you just mentioned that human trafficking is not necessarily translatable in other languages. However, it seems like it's really being brought to the forefront in our mainstream media over the last few years. And I guess my question is kind of personal in your own opinions, because it takes a lot of work, as you were saying, for each person who's working with the victims. That's a long process. However, do you believe that it's feasible to eradicate human trafficking in any of our time?
That's a very hard question. I am a political science by training, so I see everything in terms of power difference and economic global economy, etc. And I think it will be hard to eradicate human trafficking when we do not eradicate poverty. We are speaking about foreign-born in specific, and maybe this will actually apply to domestic trafficking, is when people are put in a situation where they don't have very much choice. And then also there's this myth of, I'm going to America, and there are, you know, lots of opportunities there. So, you know, It's a very hard situation. It's a very hard situation. I actually have a friend of a friend. I live in Hawaii before, so I have friends back in Hawaii. I have a friend who is from Russia, and she married. Now, this is a mix of human trafficking and domestic violence. You know, when men actually find a wife through international, whatever, marriage bureau, through a mail order bride, that's the old name for it. So my friend actually met her husband through one of those websites. And when she came to Maui, she ended up doing most of, not only the housework, but also for a job. So she ended up supporting the family, them with their 2-3 kids. And then on top of it, the husband was alcoholic. So she ended up in a shelter, and at some point I spoke to her. I live here already. But she said, you know, it's still better than staying in Russia. It really broke my heart to hear that. because we don't know. She might be dead. She might be beaten to death. Who knows? So I think when power difference, economic difference can be reduced and eradicated, then human trafficking can be, might be able to be, eradicated.
I agree with Hidiana. it's just hard because there is a huge need for labor and cheap labor. And also, you know, even if we are able to eradicate sex trafficking, which seems to be the big focus of the media, there are some reports, for example, that in the state of New York, for example, they estimate that there is about $60 million of profit that is done for agricultural labor through the exploitation of individuals in the agricultural fields, so we can get that tomato for a cheaper price. So it's just very complicated. And if you have people in a situation of extreme hardship, you know, whatever little opportunity that you offer to them, they would stay tied on that in order to have a better life.
I think, though, speaking about the foreign folks or even people who come to the Bay Area, it will be great actually to educate them and let them know where to find help, because that's one thing. They want to run away and they don't know where to find help. So if they know they can go somewhere, it might make a difference. Yeah. Yes.
Most of your examples were people that came with a visa and sponsored by someone. Are there a large number of people that come to the West Coast, say from Asia area, that are somehow brought here illegally? And how would that process work?
That first case that I explained of the minor that was kidnapped in Mexico, she was smuggled through the Mexican-U.S. border. I would say the majority of the cases that I have worked with, they have either come undocumented or they were smuggled using, or they have some type of visa fraud. It's a minority that actually had a visa. But majority of them, they were either brought here on fake documents, smuggled through the Mexican border, or a few the Canada border. So there's a lot of visa fraud involved with it. Yes, and I also have seen a lot of cases of immigrants that would migrate to the U.S. on their own, maybe because there is a huge like Latino or Asian community here in the Bay Area, and once they're already living in the United States, they see an ad offering a job, and then when they show up for that job, they're then forced into trafficked. So I have also seen cases where they were already living undocumented in the United States when they were recruited by the trafficker.
The ones that I saw mostly, they're brought here by some kind of agency, or they came with a tourist visa. So in a way, some of the people who come with tourist visa, they wanted to be in the U.S., looking for a way to stay in the U.S. But then, precisely when their visa expired, then they become very vulnerable to human trafficking. Because I can always say, if you ever go anywhere, if you ever tell anybody that I don't pay you, I'm going to call the Homeland Security and you're going to be dead. And that's the fact that the U.S. Immigration policy is very tight and very secure. The trafficker uses it to power and control the people. So, yeah.
Yes, I've read a lot about the airport workers being trained to recognize trafficked individuals, and I've also read about the tip line, I guess the Polaris tip line. As average citizens, do you encourage people to call maybe local law enforcement or the tip line or whomever, even if you're in an airplane or an airport and somebody else didn't see something, do you encourage just the average person, the average citizen, to give any tip they can to anyone in law enforcement?
it's a very hard situation. when you are on the street and you see something that looks dangerous, like you see a young woman with a child and seems to be in a situation that somebody is forcing them to do something, in times like that, it's best to call SFPD. But if you are living in a, you know, in your neighborhood and you see somebody washing cars, you know, night and day, and you never saw this person leave their house at all, then you might want to know, why is this person like hidden? You know, who is this person? In times like that, you could give us a call, and actually we can brainstorm, and maybe we will decide eventually to call SFPD, because they, you know, we don't have any legal rights or something to go to somebody's house and take somebody out. We have to work with the FBI or with SFPD.
I agree with Hediana. Just one thing that I would add is that sometimes survivors themselves, they're very scared to reach out to law enforcement. We don't know how was their relationship or their experience with law enforcement back home. They might be facing like law enforcement corruption, mm-hmm. Government corruption. So sometimes if it's a situation where you are in front of someone, they might feel more at ease reaching out to a local nonprofit instead of law enforcement.
Mm-hmm. You have a question? Do you want to?
Yes.
You have to use the thing.
Sorry. So I actually had a question regarding the law enforcement. If you guys have survivors who it turns out the law enforcement cannot prove it's a trafficking case, do you then look at U visas or VAWA or other possibilities for them to be able to stay in the country?
Yes. So, sorry, we didn't get to talk to on that side. So the fisherman that I told the story, there's two of them, actually. And yes, the FBI did not believe in them. But apparently there are two routes to actually get a remedy of the situation. So the route that our attorney used is applying for the T visa. So the T visa is an immigration route. It's like the document is like this thick, where you know, they have to tell their story, and the attorney have to, you know, prove and argue that these people are bona fide victims, and then there are a lot of testimonies, etc. Now, if they are seen as bona fide victim, then the law enforcement will give them 1 year. It's called continued presence, CP, we call it. It's a permit to live in the U.S., to live and work in the U.S. for 1 year during investigation. Even though our clients might have continued presence, our attorney will still apply for a T visa, because it's usually, the waiting is like 6 months to 8 months. So if you have a continued presence, it will work out that you have a work permit for a year, and then the T visa kick in. Yeah, the hard part is when our attorney apply for the T visa, and there's this 8 months or 6 months to 8 months with no resources at all. That's the hard part. Yeah.
Yeah, I think we have time for one last question.
Just wondering if there's coordination between the law enforcement agencies and the immigration. Make sure that the victims are not sent back, as you were mentioning, to dangerous situations abroad, and they're taken care of here, so that, you know, they're not afraid of law enforcement. Mm-hmm. Back, you know, seek help from law enforcement.
So normally we are the ones that are advocating for survivors, not to say law enforcement, they have their own criteria to decide if they want to pursue investigation or not. But regardless of their input, we work on a client-centered approach. So we do believe, and we try to support our survivors with all the resources that we have, with or without law enforcement support. But again, like Hediana says, it's a 50-50 case, you know, chance that they might take it or not. If they do take the case, they do, you know, try their best to keep the victim protected, and there are some other immigration reliefs and remedies to keep their family. But if they do not want to pursue the prosecution, our attorneys at APLO, we look for other types of options for survivors.
So in other words, we are the one who is making sure that that happened. Yeah. It's our attorney, APILO, basically. Yeah.
Our thanks to Yadma Narana and Hejiana Utarti for their eye-opening presentation on human trafficking of foreign-born individuals into the Bay Area. We also thank our audience here and our listening audience. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California in its 111th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.